Welcome to Occult of Personality at occultofpersonality.net. Thank you for listening.
Welcome to Occult of Personality, Esoteric Podcast Extraordinaire. I'm your host, Greg Kaminsky, and you can find our website at occultofpersonality.net, which features an extensive archive of recorded interviews. Occult of Personality podcast is made possible by you, the listeners, and by the subscribers to the Occult of Personality membership section. This episode is also sponsored by a donation from Steve in the UK. Now, in episode number 133, our guest is Joseph Uccello. You can find him online at joseph-uccello.com, and that's U-C-C-E-L-L-O. Joseph is a wayfarer in the Codex Naturae. While living in China, he discovered and embraced the traditional brush and ink stick. He currently runs the Viatorium Press. He practices the almost forgotten art of typography, has developed special techniques in letterpress printing, and won Bookbuilders West Award for Best Book Design for his Lovecraft homage, Pilgrimage to Azathoth. He designed, printed, and illustrated another Lovecraft-themed book entitled Al-Azif. Additionally, Uccello has worked with Ouroboros Press to design and set the type for the new edition of Theatrum Chemicum Britannicum. His first book for Three Hands Press is Ocklith, Omniform Zero. I think this book is one of the most unique and beautiful that I've ever seen. The artwork, printing, and design are superb, and the old hermetic alchemical texts within have been literally resurrected. I highly recommend it. And as a further introduction, I just want to say that Joseph's artwork is extraordinary, as are his books, printing, typography, and design. I believe his craftsmanship, insight, and attention to detail are only part of what makes him successful. The other component is a hermetic alchemical reaction initiated through his world travels, seclusion, reading Paracelsus and other alchemical writers, and an almost single-minded devotion to his work. He is truly worthy of your attention. This interview was recorded in person prior to the release of Uccello's book, Ocklith, Omniform Zero. The book is now available from Three Hands Press at www.threehandspress.com. In addition, Uccello's artwork will be featured at the 2013 Seattle Esoteric Book Conference, taking place the weekend of September 14th and 15th. For more information and to purchase tickets, browse to esotericbookconference.com. If you're able to attend the conference, I urge you to do so. It's a great event with wonderful books and a lot of amazing people. I wish I could be there, but hopefully next year. Joseph Uccello, I want to welcome you to the Call to Personality podcast. It is a pleasure to speak with you this evening. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
It's an absolute pleasure. For people who aren't already familiar with you and your work, could you just tell us a little bit about yourself and the variety of different disciplines with which you're involved?
Okay, so mainly I do art using brush and ink. But in the past few years, I've expanded out into studying typography and printing, primarily letterpress printing. And so I did art and kind of a hidden aspect for a long time. And somewhere around 2008, I decided to join my love of books to my love of ink and art, and to study typography in order to bring all of these things together in one place. So I would say primarily my creative activities are springing from hand-drawn art based in kind of a hermetic world that I'm experiencing, and everything springs from there.
Could you tell us a little bit about some of the book projects you've been involved with, both in terms of Viatorium Press, your own imprint, as well as others?
Sure. When I started Viatorium Press in 2009, it was primarily to work on a Vandercook 4 proof press, doing letterpress printing. And I was able to train on one of these old machines for a couple years at the graphic design school where I studied. They had an underground room that was an old factory, and we had a number of presses down there, and there was an old Vandercook that I got really involved with. So my first book projects were based around letterpress printing and H.P. Lovecraft, and that's how I jumped into book design, was being really dissatisfied and unhappy with the current state of book design for people, for writers like H.P. Lovecraft. Just basically realizing if I wanted to see a nice book of Lovecraft stuff, I'd have to design it myself. And I created two books, one of which was written by a scholar on the subject of Lovecraft, and the other of which was a gathering of Lovecraft's stories into a special kind of book, a pilgrimage book, using the stories of Lovecraft. Those were the first two books that I created. And at a certain point, I got involved with William Kiesel of Ouroboros Press, and we shared many interests, and he kind of got me into he turned me on to a lot of great things in the world of typography. And so before I really even knew what typography was all about, I was checking out Ouroboros books, meeting William, and eventually I studied enough typography and got skilled enough to where we collaborated on a project, or I worked with him on this project, to retypeset the Theatrum Chemicum Britannicum.
That was fantastic, by the way. Which was absolutely amazing, amazing production.
Thank you. That it was a monumental project to do. Basically, having this this book that was published in 1652 by a man named Elias Ashmole, which gathered together all the alchemical manuscripts that he could find at the time in English, because he felt a lack of alchemical work in his own native language of English. And this book was published in 1652, but pretty much had languished for hundreds of years. It had been reproduced, and we're talking about one of the most important esoteric alchemical occult books anywhere in,
maybe ever,
possibly ever. It felt like that working on it. It felt, sometimes I would just pull myself out of the work and look at what I was transcribing or look at what I was typesetting and just go, oh God, where am I? I feel like I'm in a labyrinth. This is the most amazing. This is the most amazing thing. All this lore hidden away in this book that has just kind of languished. And that was many, many hundreds of hours of work to retypeset that book. And it's deceptively simple to look at the finished product. And so even the people who work on these kinds of projects, after all the pain and toil and suffering is over, when you pick up the book in your hand, it just seems like it popped out of the sky and it was born. But really, I can look at that book and feel every detail that I worked on, and really I cleaned up all the images. We were able to restore those and make the original cuts look really good, which had not been done before. All the other editions of this book were just basically cheap facsimiles, some of them of better quality, but basically photocopies. So this theme keeps coming up with me, but it's the idea of giving a book a voice to speak with. Being a doing book design and typography and playing with these texts, to me, is a way of just doing honor to my ancestors, doing honor to the ancients, and really giving them a voice to speak with, a new voice. It's just showing them respect and giving these books a way to speak to people. Because really, when you look at the way that the face of a book is presented to you, really affects how you take in the information. So in the process of reading and looking at these things, I think it helps immensely to have them retypeset and given a new voice to speak with.
I agree. It's definitely one of the most important alchemical books ever produced. But it has importance beyond even the esoteric realm, because this is an important book historically in terms of English poetry, the history of the English language and English culture, and the history of science. And when I think about the context of that and the efforts of you, William, to bring this book back in a way that will allow people to truly appreciate its majesty is just, I'm at a loss for words as to the huge importance of what you've done.
Well, it felt great to do that service to those people from hundreds of years ago, to do that for them, to do that for Elias Ashmole. He put so much effort into creating and gathering that book. Some of these stories of him gathering this material are detailed in the in the book itself, in the Prolegomena, which in itself I feel is almost worth the price of the whole book. Just mm-hmm. reading the Prolegomena and all the lore and the amazing detail that's in there and the various stories, because these manuscripts that were gathered come from a wide range of English writing. Over a period of a few hundred years, these things were gathered right up to the time of Ashmole's day. Some of the stuff was written, you know, at that time. So we're going back to Chaucer and going up from there. So the way that Ashmole details his thinking behind it and the way that he expresses the lore of hermeticism and alchemy in that Prolegomena just is wonderful and amazing in itself.
Yeah, the book is truly a link in the Western esoteric tradition.
Yeah, and I hope, you know, there are there's a couple scholars out in the landscape there that look at Hermetic literature or English literature of alchemy, poetry, and writing. But really, I'd love to see an awakening I'd like to see an engagement with this amazing material. And it can be off-putting to just dive straight into this stuff, because some of the language, the earlier English, the earlier you go back, obviously it's very, very different than what we're used to today. Basically, when, you know, the early modern English period that is ending about 1700 is when English starts to become something recognizable to what we would speak today, in it, you know. But the writing, and I'm mostly familiar, you know, I obviously engaged a lot more with the early modern English stuff, which is the period of, I believe, about 1550 to 1700. So we're looking at around the tail end of the early modern English period. So the way that Elias Ashmole writes, and the way that a lot of the writing of the time feels is I can't, sometimes I feel like a nerd about it, because I'll read these early modern English books. I'll read Ashmole's Prolegomena, and the language itself is dizzying. The way that people wrote back then is incredible. I mean, just the structures and the way that they express themselves.
Do you get the feeling I have is that they're closer in the way they thought and expressed themselves to like civilizations of classical antiquity than they are to us today, even though we're relatively closer in time?
I agree. It's an incalculable distance from the time between then and now to the time. That's a confusing turn of phrase, but between what you're saying, that the time of Ashmole back, when you look at these ancient writings, the sense of when you look at something in the 17th century, the sense of survivals is very strong. And I'm really kind of obsessed on these ideas of things and ways and thoughts and traditions that have survived and been transmitted from person to person, from culture to culture, through the ancestral chain. Things that are in the folk tradition, or things that might not even be recorded, surviving. And it does feel like this writing from the mid 17th century, even though it's the distance in time really doesn't seem like a huge amount of time, the connection that they have with their past feels different than our connection with them. Because, well, we like to think that with all of our technological advances and everything that's going on in today's world, that we've distorted time somehow, and somehow time is moving in a completely different way. I mean, it's one of the things I find most fascinating is how can we actually tell how someone thought in 1652? How do we know that their sense of apocalypticism might have been just as strong as ours? In fact, you know, you read a lot of the writings that a lot of the people thought the world was going to end. People like Paracelsus, in their apocalyptic writings, you know, they must have felt that they were in a wondrous modern time where things were just about to, on the verge of this massive revelation that no one would be able to handle. And to feel the energy in that kind of writing, and maybe humans are always feeling that way, that every generation of humanity just feels like we're exploding into new revelatory territory. The one thing different about this previous era is that the only way they could record was through books. So their writing is just fantastically developed and dense. And it's a joy to read. You almost laugh out loud with enjoy. Well, if you're a nerd, you will. But at the language, the way it's put together, the way it's packed, I found that it took me a while, but after my mind was conditioned to that language, it was just a joy to read. Just even if, especially if you read it aloud.
It was meant to be read aloud.
Yeah, yeah, and. Wow. And it's a lot more memorable, I would say. The structures were more memorable.
Yeah, I know it's a simple analogy, but to me, reading that material is akin to like having a steak, whereas modern, even esoteric books tend to feel like fast food.
I would agree. People maybe don't spend as much time working on things, or we have it hard in the modern era. It's difficult because we're so damn distracted a lot of the times, you know, most of the, often by choice as well. And I don't necessarily, I mean, maybe that's taking us towards something, and we need to be distracted in this way right now, but I kind of enjoy diving into a good book and forcing my mind to just slow down into that world where it almost feels strange to take back your mental sovereignty when you open a book and you slow everything down to the pace of having to ingest words and take them in.
I love the way you express that. I think you could start a movement based on that whole idea.
Well, there's different movements afoot in the, right now. Things like the slow food movement or other movements that are deliberately trying to slow down and simplify things. But I wouldn't want to push that on anybody. I think it's a joy that you need to just have a craving for. Because we don't know where are we heading back to an oral tradition type of culture? Are movies a more pure expression of Hermeticism now than books can be? I mean, my first love is of books, but I don't necessarily think that I think they could be considered as decadent devices as well, even though I love that decadence.
That's true.
There's a tendency to, I worship books. I love them. I treat them like people. They're acquaintances of mine, but I also realize that, the purity of cultures that dealt in strictly in visual terms or in mythical story terms, and used mnemonic devices and encoded their own stories with all the memories they needed to survive and pass on their knowledge. And there's something so utilitarian and beautiful about that, about art and words that serve multiple functions. So when you scarified your body or wrote something on your body, it meant something, and that communicated something to everyone else around you. It encoded a memory. And I think the stories that were created by people were so vital and so amazing and so multi-purpose. They were not just entertainment. I just can kind of dream about a world where we have that kind of communication, where things are wrapped up in multiple or where multiple things are wrapped up into one useful package. Obviously we have a dizzying climate of things to consume and enjoy in our our entertainment and the books we read and the things we choose to enjoy, they don't necessarily need right now to contribute to our survival. Right now, we have enough paper to make books. For now, we do. We still have enough resources to create this frivolous entertainment. And I think I can enjoy that a lot. But I also revel in things that have multiple uses within one piece of work. Something that's aesthetically pleasing, but also useful.
Mm-hmm.
Like a well-made tool or a Leatherman knife that I would carry around everywhere that looks beautiful, has multiple uses. It's aesthetically pleasing, but it could save some. You could save your life, or it could be used to do any number of things. But I don't see that coming back. I think humans do a lot of things that are just related to our survival. So we'll enjoy all the entertainments we have. We'll have all these multiple things to play with for now. But when it's required of us to go deeper, and if we have to go into a different mode of life, then everything around us will change. I think it's probably an aberration right now, humanity.
Do you feel like your own work is a little bit of
an aberration?
Because I mean, you're. The work you do, I mean, the artistry, the typesetting, the printing, the bookbinding, these are like true craftsman skills that are, I mean, maybe I'm incorrect because, you know, esoteric books, I mean, there seems to be a resurgence of this sort of thing. But in a more general sense in the world, like craftsmanship is just not as easily found as it used to be. I know, I think it's still appreciated to a large extent by those who can afford to appreciate it.
Yeah, yeah.
But in general, I don't find craftsmanship as a value or an attitude or a goal of people nowadays.
That seems like a byproduct of just mass culture. You know, if the more things we have and the more things we use, they just won't be as well crafted and as well made. It's the whole outlook of our culture. But it also comes down to everybody wants to create things and make things. Some are more well made than others. I value a really well made book is one of the, to me, if not the most valuable thing, object I'd like to enjoy. I would agree that in today's world, really, it's not a very satisfying world in general for books, especially. But a lot of things that are created, if someone else in far away is making that thing for you, they don't care about you. They're just trying to get through the day and get their work done for the day so they can go home. They're not fashioning a blade for you specifically. It's things that you would make yourself for yourself that are integrated into your life, obviously, will have much more high of a quality, much more care. They will mean a lot more to you. I like when people pursue quality. I like finding this really esoteric, obscure world of book design and trying to just give it something, give it the care that it deserves, because it almost feels to me like a lost tradition in a lot of ways. I hate to be kind of, I don't want to come off as being arrogant about it or being thinking that my work or the kind of work that I'm seeing and doing is better, but it just feels like I feel like I care, where I feel like most other people that are doing this kind of work probably don't care about it as much as I do, don't have the kind of obsession on it, maybe. I just look at old books all the time, and I just revel in how they were put together and the soul that was in them. And they feel they have such personality and they have such soul and expression in them. And they speak to me directly. And when I look at most modern books, even books in my collection, you know, a lot of books, they just don't have they don't have that essence. They don't have that kind of soul. They're just kind of average, you know, lukewarm,
mass produced.
Somebody, they're just, I guess that's how I would feel about most, a lot of culture around me today. It just kind of feels weak.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, it's kind of a blunt way of putting it, but it does. I would look around and just, I go to the bookstore and I just go, God, this is junk, you know. Just but I guess that's anybody who cares about something and looks around at every, you know, if they're actually putting a lot of work into something and they care about it, then they're going to get disappointed by what they're surrounded by. So I can still enjoy things, but my personal obsession is creating these things and working on them, and it's fun.
Yeah. Well, I know as a consumer of books that I can appreciate the work you do even more, because so much out there doesn't measure up to those standards. And I do appreciate the way that you have married, you know, esoteric traditions with craftsmanship of books and that tradition, because I feel like they're not lost arts, but they're very arcane, esoteric disciplines, and they definitely belong together, in my opinion.
Well, this is where it intersects with alchemy and hermeticism, because if we're fashioning these objects with specific purposes in mind, we want to feel like the objects and the things that are surrounding us and that are extensions of us and that we use for our processes in life, we want to feel like those things can take on and embody that kind of power and can be embodied by you. This is where I would say that if we look at things in a hermetic way, we look at reality as an alchemist might look at reality, we start to become engaged with things in a different way. And I find it very interesting to do that. The thing about this conjunction of esotericism and craftsmanship, I think, I don't know this for a fact, I'm not a scholar, I'm just a dabbler, a dilettante in many studies, but my interest in ancient craftsmanship and ancient people and how they approached their craftsmanship, it feels like the things that were esoteric, the things that are considered esoteric now, like fashioning a book to have a special purpose or a talismanic object, those things in the past were just natural. Like the arts, the things that we call arts, lightly call arts today, that were the sciences of the past. And people, their concept of art was so different from ours. And I don't know how it was different. I just feel that from the books that I've read and the things that I've studied and the work that I've done, my experience tells me that the things that people created, they had a totally different attitude towards what they were doing. And the farther back in time you go, the more, I guess we would call it esoteric, things daily life was.
Well, that's the whole, I mean, masonry is a great example of that. That's kind of survived, where idea of constructing buildings that would be used by the general population was something that was a sacred duty and was handed over to essentially a priest craft of builders who treated it as a sacred duty.
Absolutely. It's hard to imagine a world where everything in that world was ritualized and sacralized. When you walk into the ruins of a city and you look at how an ancient city was structured, like, let's just say, an ancient city plan in China where things were structured in a certain esoteric way, or where they tried to pay attention to the landscape and to and work poetically with the surroundings. I'm fascinated by that. I think we live in a pretty blunt force world right now where things get done on a mass level, so a lot gets beaten down. But I don't think anything has been lost. I think if you just scratch the surface just a little bit, that stuff is all there. It's right under the surface. If you just walk around your own neighborhood, wherever you live, and you just peek around and poke around in reality, you'll start to see that we may have deadened ourselves or our senses to certain things that our forebears could perceive easily, but that just means that we're not seeing those things as clearly. It doesn't mean we've destroyed them or they've gone away. We've gone away in a way. So it feels like that world is right there. It's right next to us. It is us. Just personally, as a craftsman, I would like to call myself a craftsman, but I approach that world through repetitive art, through laborious kind of art. I've deliberately am a self-taught artist, and my art is extremely laborious, and I've spent many, many hours I started out with a pen, with a rapidograph pen that was like a needle, basically, like drawing with a single steel hair, and I would just spend like 4 months on a drawing without thinking about it. And through that process, I was able to gain access to something inside myself. So I've always treated it like a practice rather than strictly the modern sense of an art, because I really don't believe in the modern idea of art at all. And maybe I'm delusional.
Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Well, it gets back to the utilitarian idea. I feel like, and I don't want to come off as idealizing the ancient world or as a what is the term for
antiquarian.
That
antiquarian
like always thinking that a golden age was happening before, which every time period and every era of human history has a golden, always, it just seems like a prerequisite of being human is that there's always a golden age you're going to dream about. But my golden age that I dream about is when alchemy, the ideas behind alchemy, where you were completely immersed in your work, and the work that you were doing was used as a model or a mirror for the entire world, the microcosm involuting into the macrocosm and switching back out again and back and forth, and that reverberation between the macro and the micro, until you realize that there really isn't a difference, and your mind kind of slips into this zero point. I don't know how to describe it, but going using the detail. So the subject of ancient artists, I feel like, and this is a lot of the inspiration for my original thoughts on this come from this book, Patterns That Connect, which is a very small distillation of a huge body of research conducted by a man named Carl Schuster, who went around the world in the early 20th century gathering different patterns that were created by different cultures. And what he found in the correlations between these patterns is fascinating. It's fascinating to just see that in a lot of cultures, these patterns are still being created without the people who are creating them even knowing what they're doing. They're just repeating the same pattern. Some kind of information is being transmitted through that. We as humans are a pattern-making culture. We do things on patterns. We are attracted to patterns. Now it would be called decorative art. It would be slagged off. I mean, basically, that's an insulting term to call something. I mean, I've had people call my art when I was starting out, "Oh, that's nice. Oh, decorative art." And, you know, I just took it originally. I do my art, you know, I do it as a practice. And if someone enjoys it after the process is complete, I'm very happy about that. But I have to basically express, I'm not trying to have personal expression, but I'm trying to bring something out that's inside of me. I'm trying to explore. It's an active journey. It feels like I'm going on a trip, almost literally going somewhere to some place and unraveling something inside myself. The thing about patterns and these patterns being repeated and these motifs being used and then those motifs and patterns becoming decorative art, to me, is the central root of what is dissatisfying to me in the modern world and in modern art. I look at this book, Patterns That Connect, as an example where you just go through the book. It's got every page is full of different illustrations of different cultures from around the world who were drawn to certain patterns. And they either scarified or tattooed these patterns into their body. They painted them on their bodies. They put them on their houses. They put them on the interiors of their houses. And these people, I mean, I would look at them, or we in general would look at them as, you know, this is esoteric and magical, this process, but really this was their technology and this was their way. It makes more sense that way. Their response, their art, and the things that they crafted and created in their daily lives to use were wholly integrated into their lives and served multiple functions. So a weapon or a tool would carry decorative motifs that carried information. Stories that were told were created in structures that allowed them to be passed down orally and remembered from culture from generation to generation. So the structures were much more formulaic, and the patterns were made to be easily remembered and easily repeated, so that you can just see the first primordial human or the first person to like create a pattern. I can imagine that moment of somebody drawing something or making a pattern and then someone else recognizing it or seeing it, or maybe the person like created this pattern and it was the first time someone had symbolized something. They drew a little spiral for a wave, or they drew a triangle for a mountain, or just any number of things. It speculating on how this happened and how it developed is fascinating to me. And so I really feel like I would love to, I just would like to see and feel that kind of utilitarianism return in the terms of art, and and it's already happening. I mean, in the esoteric world, it feels like that's business as usual. It's things, well, people are more aware. It's fascinating to be involved with other people of who study these things, because really, to me, what it's about is, what are the survivals? What things have survived in these teachings and in these books that we have now? What things are in there that have come down to us? What has survived? Even if it's subconscious, these stories and this art, if we still have a way to trace things back, and to, if we still are using the most ancient symbols and patterns that humans have ever used, we're using them now. And that means that we have a direct connection to all that time. And that's what I would like to embrace. I mean, I like pop culture-y stuff and fluffy light. And sometimes that can contain that kind of, you know, you never know where these things are going to pop up. But I just am fascinated by that idea. And the alchemy and the alchemist is the classic symbol of how I would look at maybe a manifestation of that kind of thought, where,
yeah, it's really the epitome of that type of
yeah,
taking the absolute everything just to the nth degree.
Yeah, the obsession of alchemy. I think alchemy really has a massively practical side to it as well, which is, that's the beautiful thing of it. That's what attracts me to it. The contrast between how practical it is. And when I say alchemy, I mean, I know when most of the times when we say the word alchemy, we're talking about chemical work in a laboratory. But I would argue, and I know that it's probably annoying or kind of off the mark to certain people when we say that, oh, I just apply alchemy to everything. You know, I'm doing my art and I just call it alchemical or this and that, because the word alchemy is thrown around so much to apply to so many things. It's such a widespread symbol or an idea that's used now. I mean, alchemical cooking, you know, the alchemy of this, the alchemy of that. But I think from having read original documents and read texts and studied this stuff from the basis of a hermetic artist, I feel like I have a little bit of understanding of how these people thought, or at least how I channel that or experience that. Mm-hmm. Because to me it's a reverberation. I'm reading things like Paracelsus, the writings of Paracelsus, diving into these things, taking the words in and just immersing in it, and then I'm going back and walking in my neighborhood and going on a walk to think about these things, and then I'm gaining experiences out in the world. Then I'm going back to the books. Then I'm going back to the world, or I'm going, okay, these are interesting ideas, but really to keep reading is so frustrating, because when you're reading, you're gaining a lot, but you still have to jump out and apply things. And I would say that the terrains where I would apply those things would be journeying or pilgrimage or travel or movement, and then artwork, on the ground artwork, where you're in the art you're embodying into your tools, and you're experiencing that through the perspective of the tools. That makes me feel as if I'm gaining actual experience, and that to me is the most valuable thing, seeing it for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
When you can go on a long binge of studying and reading, and then you get so frustrated by that, how hermetic or how sealed that is, the natural reaction is to dive in to reality. Dive in, like, you that frustration, that itch you have to scratch, and then you're off. I mean, your own nervous system, your own body is the ultimate tool for discovery. It's a good starting. That in itself is your book. Like Paracelsus said, he called it the Codex Naturae, the Book of Nature. And Paracelsus was criticized for being a traveler, for being a wanderer. And he basically lashed out at his critics and said, I walk the book of nature. Mike, I'm a pilgrim across the book of nature. I know it from direct experience. I'm not some, you know, phony scholar who's just sitting behind my profession. I mean, this is him talking to his detractors and the people who he was against, or, and who were violently against him and his way of thinking, that this was a guy who saw it from the ground up. He got dirty. He got dirt under his fingernails. He walked around and traveled around and experienced things out in the world and talked to everybody and learned from every strata of society.
During this brief intermission, you'll hear a song called Purgatory Chasm by Mountain Mirrors from their new album Asylum Acres. And afterwards, in the second part of the interview, Joseph Uccello talks exclusively about his new book from Three Hands Press, Ocklith Omniform Zero.
Your host is Greg Kaminsky, and this is A Cult of Personality.
Can we start with the Ocklith?
Yeah, yeah.
Talk a little bit about your upcoming book.
Okay, so this is a series of books that I started to work on 2.5 years ago. I had the idea to bring different writings that were in English, either translations or original writings in English, give them new designs, and really, but taking kind of this thing that I'm trying to call arcane futurism, but that might be a totally silly term, but I was calling it arcane futurism or arcane, the arcane modern, but the term modern has no meaning. So I would just call it just hermetic typesetting or arcane typesetting, but for using the best available methods and tools that are at hand. So basically trying to take maybe the same approach that the people who originally printed these books had, where they, when they made these beautiful books, they were using what they had at hand and printing the best possible book at that time. Mm-hmm. And so I'm looking at the typographic landscape and the digital type foundries right now, and I'm finding the fonts that I want to use that I think will give these texts a totally new voice. Like I've got really into the idea that if you typeset these texts, these old texts that have really arcane style, if you typeset them in a completely new way with fonts that were created recently with all the OpenType features and everything, you could make something really fascinating, or it would be a play on the material that would be something that would convey the material in the best possible way. Like that was, you know, the main goal is to make the material present to the reader. Mm-hmm. So I thought, how do you design an occult book in the 21st century? How do you approach esoteric book design, or, you know, however I'm characterizing what I'm doing, you know? Because basically now book design, like as we were talking about before, book design had all these esoteric elements to it of proportion, form, shape. Mm. It was all very formulated, and it was approached in a certain ritualistic way. Now, I mean, that was normal to design, just like a cathedral was built in a certain way, and there were certain esoteric, what we would now call esoteric things put in there. Maybe it was esoteric at the time as well, and there was a hidden lore already being transmitted down, and people were encoding buildings and books and things with their knowledge, and they had to keep that knowledge hidden. But it's pretty safe to say now that if you think about these things and you're doing these things in your design work, well, you should be doing them. Any normal designer is aware of, you know, the primal nature of all these different things, all these shapes and proportions and the relationship to the human body and all that stuff. So I basically approached this book project with wanting to use modern or illustrations and art from this era now, from artists that are around now, coupled with these texts from, you know, most of the stuff I've been exploring is from the 17th century. So I just spent a fair amount of hours, a long time transcribing texts from the 17th century and just diving into that world of those typographers and those writers and those typesetters and the translators, and just in England in the 17th century, and became totally enamored of it, of how interesting and fascinating the book culture and the writing culture, and then imagining all the hands that these things had to go through to get to the public, the way the books were structured as well, just everything about them. I mean, all the different labyrinthine gateways, just how these books, I mean, to me, they appeared magically structured with different passageways and different, it was a ritualized system to get through this book. It was almost like their these books had, whether it was unconscious or conscious, systems of protection guarding the book itself. And that the people who, through reading the many introductions and prologues and prolegomena and to the readers and the poems at all these ritualized structures at the beginning of the book, you might think these things are boring, but then when you're spending like hundreds of hours transcribing them, you start to get into their heads and they're in this world. And it just feels like, just through these writings, through these introductory writings even, there was an awe in terms of creating the book.
Yeah, I have to tell you, I'm kind of obsessed with those illustrations they put like right at the front of the book. I think there's a word for it.
Like the frontispiece?
That's the one. It escaped me, but yeah, I'm obsessed with these things. And I feel like that is exactly part of what you're talking about, because in many, especially these type of books, as soon as you see that, it's got usually some kind of pillars or remnants of classical antiquity. Kind of reminding you you're about to enter the remnants of some ancient temple.
Absolutely, absolutely. And the engravers were in on it too, and they knew what they were doing. I mean, the things that are encoded in these frontispieces sometimes, especially, in occult books, but everywhere, pervading the culture at that time, are fascinating to, it's fascinating to delve into the symbolism of that and how these little certain little conventions and things were used. And again, it really felt like, look at all the survivals of ancient things that are in these books. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like the winged heads on these gravestones in Boston, where these things, what they're representing, supposedly they call them cherubs. But you see how these things changed from death's heads to winged heads. And, when you take those thoughts of what these things symbolize and what they are, when you just try to take it as far back as possible, I find it to be similar in books. And the thing about books is that they survived and they moved around and they traveled and they were effectively a living voice for that person or those people, and their way of thinking was encoded in these books and we can enjoy them now. But I think the beauty of just, if I can do one task and do one thing, I want to put these texts in a form that they've never been in before. And maybe I'm trying. My baseline thing that I want to keep in mind is that it's all about the reading experience and having as little space as possible between the reader's eyes, hand, and mind, not getting in the way. But I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to make a comment. It's like the anti-Kessinger approach.
Yeah, exactly. I'm trying to... Kessinger basically just takes these things, gets photocopies of them, and just junks them out on extremely pale white paper with these horrendous yellow covers. And I have a ton of them because I use them, I write in them, but they're absolutely horrible. I'm sure there's people out there and people I've talked to in person that don't care. They just say, I just want the text. I don't care about the design. And I have to say that I respect, well, no, I'm going to just say I don't respect that at all. Like that represents a totally belligerent way of thinking. I'm just going to come out and say it. Like I'm not actually like against or angry about people that are that. I think everybody has their opinion. If somebody doesn't want what I'm doing as a designer or what other people like me are doing as a designer, that's fine. I don't want them to want it. But I would say that if you can see the difference when you read something, I mean, it's all aesthetics. Like, I would ask that person, okay, you just want the text. What does that mean? Is the text a disembodied being that exists nowhere? Is it a concept floating in the air? No, it has to be embodied in something. So if you're embodying a text, it's just like anything else you're embodying. The better designed it is, the better put together, the better it fits with the human body, the better it will work. Mm-hmm. I mean, it will function, especially if you're studying the occult, the esoteric. This should be of paramount importance to you. I mean, I hate being so like preachy about it, but I feel so strongly about it just because I've experienced it. It's not an abstract idea with me. Like, I've heard the different voices of when I read things. I know I've read these junky Kessinger books that have no respect for the text. They're just a crap facsimile. And then I've read something that's had lavish care put into it. And I mean, if one thing can be criticized on this kind of like heavily designed type of book, it is like you don't want the text, you don't want the design to get in the way. And that was always my first goal. Or my first goal is that, you know, I want to create like a mounting for the text, like you would mount a beautiful diamond in a ring. Like, it should have the perfect lead up. It should have the perfect, you know, flow and breath into the text so that when you reach that moment, you're not distracted. But I always was pushing it as far as I could, saying how much of, I want to, you know, ostensibly my only goal is functionality, but you can create a lot of beauty with, I mean, the beauty comes from the functionality, but it's when you can justify beauty through functionality, that's when it works the best. And this Ocklith project, I can't judge my own work, but I just hope that people who read it and experience the book get that enjoyment out of it, where it's like a premier reading experience, where it's for people who just want to revel in and enjoy and get information that way, as archaic as it is maybe today. But there's actually a lot of people who just love that form of entertainment. And I would just say it, that it's just like anything else, any other form of how you embody or experience things. When you watch movies, when you wear clothes, when you do anything, you would want it to be the most comfortable and beautiful, well-designed, well-put-together. I mean, I would just, I haven't had a chance to like berate somebody in person about this question, but I would ask them that, like, okay, so when you buy shoes, do you just not care how well they fit? Like, you just want shoes? You don't care? Like, maybe there's people out there who just don't care about anything aesthetically, but I would say it springs from functionality. When something is really functional, that's like the highest form of enjoyment you can get from an art object, you know, a well-made backpack, a well-made knife. But after working on this project, the project was projected to have 7 books.
Wow.
Because I was gathering material and I was transcribing and kind of wildly going through all this material, and I've got 2 books that are already set up. The first book is numbered 0, and this book is called Omniform. And this first book is going to be published by Three Hands Press, and I'm very happy and grateful that they picked up this series and saw something in it that resonated with them and then helped me in the process of getting this book out. Because I'm so immersed in the design and the work on it that my wherewithal is not necessarily in the rest of the process. Mm-hmm. So it's a perfect fit. Like, I love the Three Hands Press and Zonon are
Love it.
I adore their books.
Yeah, me too.
So it was really a great tour. I mean, and I spent a lot of time just toiling and being kind of miserable working on these, because after the transcribing and just the, it becomes so abstract on the computer screen that I started to lose touch with it. And the thing about issue zero, I want every book in the series of seven, it'll be numbered 0 to 6. And it will each of the books will have a theme, and the text will work around that theme. The first theme right now of Omniform is the craftsman, is this Gnostic idea of the craftsman is what it centers around, but embodied through the texts of Paracelsus and his one of his kind of followers of his ideas, not a direct follower in his lifetime, but a man named Oswald Kroll, who lived in Prague under Rudolf II. These two men, these texts are translations of texts by these two guys. Most people probably that are listening to this know Paracelsus, but these texts that I'm presenting of his are translations from the 17th century. So they've brought the essence and the sense of Paracelsus across in that writing, because it's relative to his time period. So Paracelsus dies in 1541. This book is the mid 1600s. So it is a fair amount of time after, but the way the essence of the writing and the way that it's written, the translation, I mean, really comes through to me. It really brings the material through. More so, I mean, there's more modern translations of Paracelsus coming out right now from scholars, but well, it's a trickle, but it's happening. It's slowly happening. The books are hard to get a hold of. But I thought something about these early texts, these early translations, the translators, I wish I could meet or talk to these guys, because they usually were anonymous. And they seem to be really fascinating people in and of themselves. Mm. Like, to sit down and translate hundreds of pages of Oswald Kroll's, like, gnarled, intense German writing, like, that blows me away. And to try to do this with Paracelsus as well, I think a lot of modern translators are probably really frustrated. Like A.E. Waite, his translations, he often just, in the little notes, he expresses like active annoyance and dislike with Paracelsus, and just I find that hilarious. But I think the translations from the 1600s really are poetry in and of themselves, like poetry. And I'm looking at this as, not only is it hermetic knowledge, and hermetic knowledge through the eyes of Paracelsus, who was a totally unique character, but it's beautiful writing. The writing itself is a trance-inducing thing to read. The act of reading it, to me, is the trigger to gain the knowledge. The act of reading the words, and I tried to set the type, and in book design, it's such a subtle thing, and it's so hard to recognize, and it's something you shouldn't even notice, but every detail is all decisions. Like, you make thousands of tiny little decisions at every point. It's such a fine little world of design, and it's just not recognized. Even the person doing the design, it just seems like you're working on a machine, and then you pull back from this machine, and it's like all looking at all the gears and the weirdness of it. And it's still, you know, the science of reading is not really even a science. It's still kind of a floating thing about how humans interact with the books. Obviously, you're holding the books in your hand, you're using your eyes, you're using your mind, you might be using your speech to read it. And I set the type in these books. I tried to set them almost as if they were poetry. When I held the type and shaped it into a certain shape, and the way that I set the paragraphs, as the lines moved and cracked, they read like the most beautiful, fantastical poetry you've ever read in the English language. Mm-hmm. I mean, and it's not just somebody writing poems for fun. It's a hermetic, deep hermetic study. This Paracelsus is imparting this knowledge that he's gained through his experience in life and through his travels and journeys. And it, all his, the suffering and the experimentation and the mining and the healing and everything that he's done and experienced and the persecutions that he's gone through, you know, he's bleeding it through this text, and he's unlike any other writer from that or any other time, just in the fury of his writing, the immediacy of it. It like grabs you. It just grabs you by the throat and makes you listen, you know. And coupled with that, with the mid-17th century translation into English, it just sings. I mean, it's like, it, to me, I was listening to a lot of Black Sabbath while I was designing this particular book as inspiration, but it's kind of like Paracelsus is like the Tony Iommi of Hermeticism. You know, he's like the... to put it
great
in,
analogy.
If you really want like a direct, this guy's always coming up with good riffs on anything. I mean, and he just has a soul. He has like a depth of soul to him. He's a wounded hero, you know, and he just, you can tell he's been through, you know, physical wounding and like he's been down, and the music that he comes out with from these spaces, you know, to me, it was, you know, very similar, like the play between that. Mm. But this, so there's already another book down the line that is almost that has been all transcribed, and now I'm working on that. But I want to, the first book in the series, I used my own art to illustrate.
Mm-hmm.
I used my own art as the wayfinding system in this book. So each chapter head has an illustration that I've done at some point. And I've kind of culled drawings from the past 13 years that I've been working.
Wow.
So some of them are, you know, and it's all work that I love. You know, I have a lot of personal feeling for, but I really wanted the work to, It works with the text. So it works in concord with the text. And even before I was like actively studying, where I was just, I started out studying the imagery of alchemy through books like The Golden Game and the Alchemy and Mysticism, the Toshin book. I started out just as a visual student, studying the imagery and experiencing it over and over again and becoming completely immersed in the symbols of alchemy. Mm-hmm. And that's, so these earlier drawings are just visceral reactions to seeing these images and recognizing something in them, actually going, why am I attracted to that? Why does that say immediately, without even reading any of the text, why does that immediately say something to me?
Mm-hmm.
Why am I why does that take me somewhere? What is going on with that?
Mm-hmm.
And so those first pieces, those older pieces are that visceral reaction, having to respond to that, like just feeling commanded, you know, mm-hmm. saying what this picture of this fountain and this like naked king, you know, or this crow flying and the eggs and all the symbolic train of alchemy, you know, I mean, the most vast storehouse of symbology and ancient symbols,
yeah.
Probably a dumping ground or a place where just the last of the ancient world just got dumped into alchemy as far as Europe is concerned.
Yeah,
this is the last, this is like the last stopping point before the Enlightenment, you know? So all the survivals we're going to find are in the occult, in magical grimoire and alchemy, you know? That's right. This is where we got it. We'll, we're, as archaeologists of this, and then we take it into our lives and experience it. My personal way is doing, jumping into these art pieces and then getting so immersed that it's a complete training ground in and of itself, in the paper, in the ink, in the pen, and in the music that's flowing, you know, and it's just becoming completely to the point of, you know, tears streaming down your face when you're just lost in it so deeply. And then you come out and think, okay, I go to work in 3 hours, and what, you know, what's this, what is this world I just experienced, you know? And then now I'm going outside into the, the real, or the other world, or the, another part of that same world. Like, what is it that, so those early drawings have a real, I can almost read them. I can, I know what was going on in my life. So they have a personal feel, but I hope that that kind of universal alchemical language comes across, because I mean, I was just grasping for it. I would see labyrinths, owls, kings and queens, plant forms, and just take them into myself and then bring them back out and play with them in that arena, in the hermetic arena. And so this first book, by necessity, was all my own art. And that was a whole journey just to pull out all these old scan, all these old drawings and scan them. Some of them have gotten, have new, different owners in different parts of the world. I had to do a lot of legwork to get a whole, because I just didn't, I would work on something for months at a time and do these, just the most elaborate, painstaking, and then just, it would go for a song and I would just, it would just disappear. Like people, there's different, they're in different places that, of people, some, in some cases I have no contact with, or I have some ancient scan that, that I happened to do when I was in a more thoughtful mood, you know? So, but mainly the art is there to illustrate the concepts, to bring out the concepts, to be like a vista that opens up after each chapter. So it heads each chapter as a way of a gate or a key or a way in. And I'm hoping that they serve as kind of a mnemonic device in the text, in the same way that, like monks who were illuminating a manuscript would draw like grotesque little beings and beasts and creatures in the margins of the pieces. And these had different reasons for being drawn there. I mean, a lot of, you know, some of the illuminator monks disapproved of this kind of practice, but one of the big things that these grotesque images served to do was be in contrast with the canonical imagery inside, but also to serve as a mnemonic device for remembering certain, I mean, these kind of shocking images immediately bury in your mind. They encode whatever, like that's anything violent or extreme or intense or shocking, fascinating. You're going to remember it. And chances are you're going to carry the text with you that, 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 that image signed. So I kind of, I mean, this is what comes out from me when I confront these issues or these concepts or ideas, when I go deep in to do this art, this is what comes out. So I, it, it says something, maybe you could study it psychologically and just say, and look at a lot of the forms and images and things that come out. But then if you start to look, like I've been doing, at these ancient patterns and then how these ancient patterns slowly become encoded in things like alchemy, it just, you see it everywhere. You see that humans have these innate patterns buried within us. And when we go deep into ourselves, we can bring out these ideas and what you can contact and what you can bring up is fascinating. The things that are going on inside of us, you know?
So thank you. So the book is Ockleth Omniform.
Yeah, it's called the first one. The full subtitle is called The Labyrinthus Archidoxe.
Nice.
Which means the labyrinth of primal glory. And so that's the name of the series itself.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Ockleth is the name of the series, and then the Labyrinthus Archidoxe is like the descriptor of the series, the subtitle.
Mm-hmm.
And then this book zero is called Omniform.
Okay.
And that will be out from Three Hands Press, hopefully very somewhat soon. What is it? I'm hoping it will be out by August. We'll see. You know, I don't want to think about, you know, I'm trying to put the process out of my mind and just let the people who are taking care of the making of the book, you know, do their thing. But
it sounds phenomenal. I'm really, really looking forward to it. And
thank you.
Very excited to get my copy.
Thanks.
So why don't we just maybe be a good opportunity to remind people where they can find you and your work online?
excuse me. My website is my name, Joseph Uccello. It's with a dash in between. So it would be Joseph Uccello.com. And then I also have a blog for Viatorium Press, for my personal imprint, which is viatoriumpress.blogspot.com.
And people will be able to see and hear you talk about your work at the upcoming Esoteric Book Conference in Seattle?
If all goes well and the book is ready, I'll be probably speaking to everybody about it. We're hoping to have a book launch in August. If all goes well and everything goes smoothly, I'll probably do a talk in August in California,
mm-hmm.
in Oakland or Berkeley. But we'll see. I try not to think about anything into the future right now. I'm already hard at work on the next two volumes of this. The next volume will be dealing with visionary states,
nice.
Of alchemists and magicians. So
excellent.
And shaping up to be interesting.
Now that one will have artwork by you and others, or just others?
I still am figuring out how that will work. I have a list of artists that I have in mind that I really admire. So hopefully I won't have to do the art this time.
Well, if it's for whatever it's worth, I really like your artwork, and I'd rather see at least some of your artwork in the books than
thank
not.
You. Well, I appreciate that. I think I'm always very happy and I feel great if people can get something out of my art and enjoy it, because it's such an ingrained process for me that it's hard to get perspective as far as the viewer. But when somebody does resonate with it, it makes me really happy. I'm glad for that. So.
Excellent.
I appreciate that.
You're welcome.
Please join Joseph Uccello in the Occult of Personality membership section for a conversation about the one and only Paracelsus. And remember that Occult of Personality podcast is made possible by subscriptions to the membership section. Just go to occultofpersonality.net/membership and click the Join Now button. Thanks again for listening, and until next time.